Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in Soho. Today, I have a great guest, C.J. Raycraft, who is a 2004 alum of FCI, now ICC, but he is just rocking it in New Jersey, and I really want to talk to him about everything that he's been doing. He's the managing partner and head chef of Westfield, New Jersey's modern French brasserie, Amuse, and in just 2 years, he's received unbelievable acclaim and praise from the food critics and dining patrons, and he has been picked as one of the top restaurants in the state of New Jersey. So, you know, we don't usually have as many people as I would like from New Jersey on this show, so I'm glad you crossed the river. In fact, the New York Times food critic, Marissa Bates, referred to CJ as a thoughtful and passionate chef. We'll get into that later. And you have a first-class brasserie, and you do signature profiteroles infused with salted caramel ice cream. She called it, the New York Times called it, the best profiteroles in the state.
That was very nice of her.
And you know what? That also, before you had your own place, you served as chef de cuisine at Chez Catherine, a very, very venerable institution in New Jersey.
Yeah, we're still very close friends, the owner and I, today.
Yeah. So we're going to get there. And most importantly, CJ recently became the last honoree of the International Academy of Gastronomy's Prix au Chef de l'Avenir, the leading chef of the future, which is a huge, huge distinction. He's one of only three American chefs ever to be honored with this global culinary distinction, and you're not going to believe it. I was just with Wojciech Amaro from Poland, who had received that, Korea, and they brought him all the way to Korea because of that particular honor. So people out there, if you've never heard of this leading chef of the future by the International Academy of Gastronomy, which is located in France, it's a huge, huge honor. So, CJ, so great to have you here. Welcome home.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back here in New York and spending some time with you, of course.
So tell me, are you a Jersey? Were you born in Jersey?
I was born in New York, on Staten Island.
Long time ago. That's close, like a suburb of New Jersey.
Right. Well, everybody seems to move to Jersey from Staten Island.
Yeah.
So we moved over to Jersey in 1988, so I was about six. So pretty much born in New York, raised in New Jersey. I don't say grown up because I don't know if I've done that yet. I'm still working on it.
You are very young. But tell me, what age were you getting interested in food?
Well, I mean, I used to make my own breakfast when I was a little kid. You know, every morning my mom would have me do my own scrambled eggs and things like that.
Oh, at what age?
Oh, God, I was probably four or five. And then, you know, and throughout the years, you know, I got a chance to wash dishes at an Elks Lodge function at about 11 years old. And I made like $50 for a night at a wedding. Like, you know, it was under the table, you know, $50 cash. And it was like my whole eyes lit up. My whole life was like, this is fantastic. So, you know, I got to do some more odd jobs like that over the years. And then once I got into high school and able to work on a regular basis, I started working in restaurants, bussing tables and waiting tables and dishwashing and learning to cook and all that. So kind of at a young age, I kind of got in the restaurant bug and you know, and then it actually kind of went away for a little while. Went into to study college at East Carolina University.
What were you studying?
I was studying business, but I ended up being really into the party scene and just didn't really. So I always joke that I, you know, majored in partying and minored in alcoholism. So about 3 years into that, I decided that I was working full-time in a restaurant, not going to classes, and racking up bills. And I was speaking with my parents, and they said, you know, you probably should change your life and figure something else out. So I started to search for culinary schools. In my searches, I looked at the Art Institute. I looked at Culinary Institute of America, and both of those kind of were too much for me. They were all inclusive, and they give you a degree and all this and that. And it really, college was not for me. I was not a classroom kid. I'm a hands-on type of guy. And when I found the French Culinary Institute, which is now the ICC, it was go in, and the first day you're cooking. Like, I mean, I fell in love with that idea. I came to tour the school. And, you know, I think I signed up that day. I mean, we went to the bursar's office, I think, almost immediately and just filled out the paperwork.
Who were your chefs? Who were you?
Let's see. My opening chef was Chef Martin.
Oh, so you went at night.
I went at night. I went part that because that was the other thing was that I could work during the morning. And you know, I was working at a bank, so I could work during the morning. And then
you are a worker.
Yeah, I always have been. I remember when I was 16, I had three jobs. I was working for the town during the day, picking up trash on the side of the road, restaurant a couple nights a week, and gas stations Saturday, Sunday.
Why did you work so hard?
Yeah, I don't know. Just was.
You were bored.
Did you
like the money?
Of course, like the money. I worked this. I worked probably more now than I ever did. But
I'm going to explore that a bit because, the people listening out there, I think there are people that are just avid diners and want to understand the psyche of the chef. But I have found that a lot of our listeners out there are young chefs, young cooks who are really trying to be, you know, who they want to be in this profession, their own chef. And so I'm going to try to get from your perspective, what are the skills that you really need, and what are the attitudes that you really need to be a chef and a successful chef? So is this work ethic? I mean, if you don't have the work ethic that wants to do long hours, three jobs are long hours.
Sure.
I mean, is this a profession for
yeah,
you?
I don't want to say no. There are lots of aspects in the culinary field. There's a lot of corporate dining and different things like that, where you can have a normal type of 9-to-5 type of job and be in food service and that's okay. But if you want to get into being extremely creative and you really want to express yourself and you really want to, you know, go put yourself out there and do your own thing, you really have to put the time in.
So your work ethic is extraordinary, and you were saying that there are other jobs in the industry. But we'll get into this later.
Sure.
When you're looking for someone to work for you, The work ethic, I
absolutely. Yeah, you want someone that's ready to show up early and work late and not complain about it, because there's always something to do, and there's doesn't ever seem like there's ever enough time.
Right.
So, that's just kind of it. It's, you know, when you work in I would say in restaurant kitchens, you're gonna run into that more often than not. And then, you know, I mean, of course, when you're getting paid hourly as a young chef coming up, it's one thing. But when you cross that bridge into slavery, I mean salary, it's a whole other ball of
wax. So
if
you weren't going to be a chef when you were a teenager, what do you think you would have, what profession other than alcoholism and partying were you interested in?
Yeah, I was looking at, I mean, you'd name it, communications. I thought I was going to be a sports agent. I was going to be an accountant. I don't know. I don't know where that came from. But
You did study business,
right?
So yeah, and did studying business really help you now in running?
It definitely has helped some, of course. I mean, I wish I had studied a little bit harder, because there's a lot, I wish I knew a little bit more than I did. But there's a lot of this that's been learning on the fly, which is kind of my story. I'm very I'm kind of an adaptable person, so I would categorize myself as a survivor. So I find ways in and out of situations that, you know, maybe I shouldn't have got myself into, but I always find a good way out of it. So,
when coming up on the culinary ladder, did you have some, who did you aspire to be, and who were your mentors?
Well, I mean, I got introduced to Shea Catherine when I was here. Andre Saltner had a, I think it was like an exit meeting. It was like the end of level 3 or right before level 4 when there was only 4 levels. I know it's changed now, but back when.
That was 13 years ago.
I know. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I was talking before. Oh, that building was a parking lot, and this was this, and it was just totally different. It's
so
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. The school's pretty much.
Oh, yeah. It's lovely. Now there's no more restaurant, which is it's sad at the same time.
Yeah, we had to close Lake Cole because, you know what, the rent?
This
is New York City.
Right.
2016. The rent was going from $125 a square foot to over $400
a
square feet.
Unbelievable.
You can't sell chicken, you know, for a reasonable price. You have to be, you know, we were victims of Uniqlo, Bloomingdale's, and Topshop coming to us on Broadway.
And Starbucks and whatever else.
Yeah, that can afford those rents. So
it's crazy. I don't know how they afford it anyway. But
you know, we're going to talk about why you're in New Jersey. But let's get back to Shea Catherine.
Sure.
Why don't you tell us about Catherine and what kind of restaurant that was.
Okay, so it's
what drew you to it?
It got high praise from Andre Saltner. He said, you know, he knew DDA, the owner, very well from skiing and from when he worked at La Grenouille, which is a wonderful place just uptown here. He's a front-of-the-house type of guy. Specializes in doing Dover sole tableside and these wonderful older-style French traditions. And So I went in for an interview, an interview with him, and the chef at the time was Kara Decker, another French Culinary Institute graduate, alumni. She's doing very well for herself, too. She just got a new position in Mountainside, New Jersey, at a place called Public House. She's doing fantastic stuff. So I worked underneath her and the other sous chef, Rebecca. So I worked for them for about
a lot of women
a year.
in a French chef's kitchen.
It was a lot, and they were both extremely talented.
Did you find it different working for a woman chef? Do you think attitude in the
kitchen? My parents split up when I was 12 and or 11, and I was kind of raised with my mom and my sister, so I was used to taking orders from ladies. so it wasn't too much of a stretch for me to get used to. I was there to learn and grow, and so I mean, I was a little cocky back then, but, as most 22-year-olds are. So, but I learned a lot from them. And then I had the opportunity to, a new restaurant was opening in Newark, New Jersey, called 27 Mix. And the owner knew a friend of my mom's, and he called me up and wanted to interview me to be his opening chef. He knew I was young, and I was hungry to advance my career and really make a name for myself. So we had an interview, and he took a chance on me. He hired me to be his opening executive chef.
How many years out of school did you take that?
It was just about 1 year.
Wow. All right. Yeah. I got to explore that a little. After going to school and only being in a kitchen for a year, are you really ready to go in? And...
No, absolutely
okay,
not.
Okay. Let's talk about that, because a lot of people think coming out of school, well, not a lot, anybody here thinks coming out of school they're ready for this. But after a year, that's really, that was really show. So what did you learn from taking that position?
Oh my God, so much. I mean, when I interviewed, there was no electricity or plumbing in the building, so it was literally ground up. So the experience for me was, it's priceless. I mean, it was just, I went in and I mean, I was painting, I was spackling, I was helping lay out where we're going to put this in the kitchen, where are we going to put that, what kind of plates are we going to buy, how many, what are we going to do with silverware, what is the menu going to be, what is this? I mean, so it was, I remember I mentioned being a survivor and putting myself in situations. This is a key example of, you know, stepping into something that probably wasn't ready for. But I'm such a good BS artist that I was able to talk them into hiring me.
So let me get back into the psyche. You've only worked 1 year.
Right.
What in your mind, was it, I just want to do my own thing? Or didn't you want to go learn under anybody else? Or,
you know, I was thinking about money. And also, I have this kind of an attitude, well, especially at that time, I was a lot more, but if you tell me I can't do something, I will show you how it's done. And that's kind of, and I remember the last words that when I gave my notice, the one of the last things that DDA, the owner of Shea Catherine, said to me, he said, "You'll never make it." And going forward two years later in 2007, I had left the mix to go work somewhere else, and DDA called me up to be his head chef. So, and the first thing he said to me was like, "Remember I said that you would never make it? I was wrong." So,
wow.
It was,
So what was your first menu like?
Well, they had a restaurant consultant involved, and he kind of had some basics. And it was a very eclectic menu. We had stuff from enchiladas to a hamburger to, I'm trying to remember.
It was
now.
A real mix.
It was a real mix. Yeah, they wanted to originally call it 27 Mex. They were going to do a Mexican-style restaurant. Okay. They went into 27 Mex, and we had, I mean, and then, you know, we had different specials all the time, different salads, and it was really busy for lunch. I mean, we had, at one point, like a two-hour wait during lunch.
Did you get good reviews?
We did. We got a review from the New York Times. David Corcoran said we were on a rating of, I believe it was satisfactory, good, very good, and I guess extraordinary was the third, or excellent. We got good, which we were kind of like which would be like a two-star. We were kind of a bistro, very fast-paced. Yeah. We weren't
fine dining.
No, not at all. It was very, I mean, no linen on the tables, very eclectic menu, open kitchen, a bar when you walked in, high tops, and then a bar literally looking into the kitchen. So people would sit from where you are to where I am, which is about 3 feet, and be able to look into the kitchen and see us. So it was very
different.
So
where different. Did you go from there?
From there, I was talking with ownership. I had moved over. I was doing a GM job and the executive chef job. So I was doing wearing a couple hats there, and I didn't feel like I was being fairly compensated for my time. So I got an offer to be GM of a place down in Spring Lake Heights. It was a gastro pub type thing, and I ended up going there. I think I was there for about 3 months before I got the call at Shea Catherine, and I gave notice there and moved on. I think I gave them like
so. You went
weeks.
Back to Shea Catherine.
I did. They hired me back. Yeah,
as the head chef,
as his chef de cuisine is what he called it. Yeah.
Wow. And so, how long did you stay there?
7 years.
Ah, and what did you learn in those 7 years?
I mean, tons. Yeah, you know, we had the 2007. Was it 2007? 2008 economic downturn. We had all kinds of, you know, I mean, there was a lot of different obstacles that we could overcome. When I took over, I mean, we were doing, it was crazy numbers. We were doing, you know, in a 30 seat restaurant, we were doing 40, 50 dinners Monday. I mean, Tuesday through Thursday, and then 60, 70 on Friday, and 120 on Saturday. I mean, we were rocking. And then it was like somebody just turned off the faucet after that turndown when Lehman Brothers and all that went down.
Amazing.
So, you know, we had a grand degustation menu with like 15 courses, and we had, you know, like all this fun stuff. And then all of a sudden it was just like, we had to come
and
up
that,
with
And that's not coming back. I don't think so.
Yeah, not anytime so. Soon.
It doesn't seem we're going to have to come back, because we're going to have to take a break.
Sounds
right here.
Sounds good.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is CJ Raycraft from Restaurant Amuse in Westfield, New Jersey, and a proud alum of this institution. We're
very
so
proud.
Happy. We're very happy to have you back. So let's get into, so you, 7 years, so it seemed like you bopped around a lot in your first 5 years of being a chef, but when you got to stay someplace 7 years, did you get bored? Were you allowed to do the menu? Was DDA, what was your relationship with DDA, and why did you stay 7 years?
Well, I had a lot of say in the menu, especially early on. Like I was saying, we had a grand degustation menu, we had tasting menus, so he had input, he had what he wanted. He's very old school in a way, so he was set in his ways. And we would butt heads from time to time, but we had a very strong mutual respect for each other. We were both very opinionated, and so there were some heated battles. We used to scream at each other. I mean, it was like an old world kitchen a little bit sometimes, and it was fun at the same time. But he had a lot of influence on different things. He wanted certain things a certain way, and it was his place, so we did what we did. The money was fantastic. The hours were great. I mean, he was closed basically half day Saturday, all day Sunday and Monday. So, I mean, it was like a 4.5-day schedule. I long for those days. It was actually I'm kind of miss having time off a little bit, but don't tell him I said that. Too late now. But
when did you know it was time to leave?
You know, the last couple of years, I had been searching for my own place. I wanted to kind of find, take the risk and go out on my own and do my own thing. Actually, right up and almost until I left, I was going to actually, I had an interview with another restaurant nearby, and I was going to leave, and that's when I met my business. Well, I mean, I had met my business partner, I guess, at some point. He was a very good customer of Shea Catherine. So, and we had become close over the years because, funnily enough, the alcoholism did take over, and I ended up getting sober through these years when I was about 26. So, thankfully, still to this day. But he was instrumental in getting me that help. So we became close over the years. And he was retiring from his business, and he wanted to diversify and open a couple different ones. When he saw that I was looking at doing this move to another restaurant, he said, it's kind of a lateral move. I'm retiring. I'm going to be having some funds coming in. Why don't we open a place? So my ears and eyes, my eyes lit up, and, here we are.
So that's how you found your funding.
Right.
Wow.
So I really didn't.
And he really believed in you.
Right. Well, his whole thing was, he said he doesn't believe in ideas. He believes in people. So, I'm doing, we work together really well, and he's more of just a silent guy. He doesn't really get involved with day-to-day stuff, but he's there for me to lean on when I need help, and he's been, he's great.
So describe the restaurant, how many people you have working, how many seats.
Okay, so we have about 50 seats. It is, I've heard it described, it's a very modern, it's a warm-feeling restaurant, even though it's modern. It's a lot of light woods and light colors. And we don't have tablecloths. We have butcher block tables that are like a light pine or beautiful. I sourced them from the Pacific Northwest. Mm. It's a knotty pine, so they're lightweight, so it's not too much of a big deal to move them around. They're not too heavy. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful. We have a darker like a almost like a chestnut mm-hmm. floor, and we have the beautiful pine that pops off of it. We have lateral pine planks all around the restaurant, about halfway up the wall, so that you can, you know, really brings all the pine and showcases the wood in there.
Sounds Scandinavian.
Right. That's what I, that's the other, we hear that. I hear California, I hear Scandinavian. So it's very, it's just like a kind of nice feel to it. I'm big into very white plates, probably from my time here. And I actually have rim, all my plates are rimless. So it kind of gives me like a bigger you know, palette. So I can really kind of play around with that.
So tell me about your menu.
Right now we have a mixture of small plates and some entrees, and we change a lot, definitely depending on the season. Right now we have like a beautiful, you know, tuna ceviche. That's a very, very popular, one of our most popular dishes. The one I cooked on Good Day New York a couple weeks back was a dish with scallops and avocado. But we, you know, with each season, we kind of change everything up. So maybe some of the proteins might stay the same, but we always change the sides based on seasonality.
So how big a staff do you have?
In the kitchen, we have about five of us total, including myself.
Does that include the dishwasher?
Including the dishwasher.
Wow.
So.
And how many covers do you do on a Saturday?
You know, we like to do around 100, you know, 120. So, you know, the more the merrier, of course. But, you know, we're open six full days. We do a brunch on Sundays. We do, you know, dinner.
What day are you closed? Monday?
Mondays. So I'm here on my day off with you.
That's true. Today's Monday. Where did the Chef of the Future come in?
Well, here's another, you know, just situation that comes upon me. I had the president of the American East chapter of the Academy of Gastronomy, Sevi, he's a resident in Rumson, New Jersey. He and his wife and another couple came up for lunch one day, did not mention anything, came in, had lunch. And asked my manager, I really would like to meet the owner. I'd really like to meet the chef. So they were sitting in a booth. We have really nice booths on the one side of the restaurant. So the four of them were sitting in a booth, relaxing. They just had a late, long European style lunch. You know, a couple bottles of wine. They were relaxing, no problem. So I go to say hello, and you know, because basically they're it. That's who's in the restaurant at this point. It's about 2:30, 3 o'clock. So he starts telling me, oh, I'm part of this International Academy of Gastronomy. We want to do a dinner here. We love your place. We love the food. You know, we just think it's wonderful. So I had never heard of this group before. You know, I mean, I'm pretty much in my own world most of the time, just, you know, in the restaurant. Between the restaurant, I'm on the board, you know, the board of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm involved with the New Jersey Restaurant Association. Like, I have, you know, a lot of plates spinning. So I'm, you know, I don't get out much. So, but... You know, he kind of told me about it. So then I did a little research on it. We set up a dinner. He came in another time for lunch, him and his wife, and we sat down. We had lunch together, and we chose the menu together. And he said, you know, if the dinner goes over well and the Academy members agree, we'll put you up for this award, for this Chef of the Future award. So I said, oh, lovely, wonderful. So it was around, I think it was April 15th of 2015, they came in and had the dinner. It was about 30 people or so, and a lot of well-to-do people. You know, a lot of big names and local. I would say local business celebrities. You know, some big car dealers and people you see on TV on commercials and things like that. So, there's a lot of juice in that organization. So they came. They enjoyed. They had their meal. They enjoyed everything. They have one gentleman who's a doctor. Critique everything afterwards. So dish by dish, he was going over everything with me. You know, I'm out there talking with him and he's asking me questions. And what do you think about this? And why was this like this? So, you know, we had a little bit of conversation, and then, at the end of that, they kind of had a vote and decided to, at least put my name in the hat for this, award. And,
so it was a global competition,
right? Well, I mean, I'm not sure if it's every country or, but they do. They have a bunch of different countries that each. There's a bunch of, on the website. There's a list from different winners from different countries, and I believe it was sometime in February 11th, February 12th, right around Valentine's Day. I got an email from Sevi. Call me immediately. So you know, I call them and, you won the award. They just had the vote in France and you won. And, you know, so we have to set up a dinner. I'll come in with Marianne. We're going to come in. We'll come in for lunch. We'll set up the dinner. You have to receive the award. And
exciting.
It was wild. You know, I mean, we go from meeting this gentleman at a lunch table and, you know, I'm thinking, I don't care. I never heard of this. I don't know what it is. And then, you know, to having a dinner and then hearing about this award and being put up for it, winning it, and then, you know, the journey that's been afterward has been wonderful. I've gotten a lot of really good press through, you know, from this award, with FSR Magazine and New Jersey Biz Weekly and, you know, being on TV and everything else. It's just been amazing. So
what was futuristic?
Well, apparently the way that the word of L'Avenir translates to is a successful future. So there's the parameters for the award are you have to be a chef under 40. You have to be a working chef. If you're just walking in and you're telling people what to do and you just – that's it. If you're not cutting the onions and you're not, you know, hands-on, they don't really want to – they asked all these questions to Sevi. Is he actually there every day? Is he actually cooking? Is he – you know, is he involved with the restaurant and the making of the dishes and everything? So, so I met all that criteria, and basically, what they're expecting from me is they say, okay, well, we're giving you this award now, and we expect future greatness from you. So that's kind of the way that they set this award up is that they're wishing you
a little bit of pressure there.
Yeah, no. So they expect a successful future from me by bestowing me with this award. So, I just hope I can do them justice and the previous award winners justice and you know live up to that lofty goal and expectation. So,
great. We're going to be taking a little break here, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is C.J. Raycraft from Westfield, New Jersey. His restaurant is Amuse, and we just heard he was chosen as chef of the successful future by the French International Academy of Gastronomy. And that's quite an honor. Having met some of the other ones, you probably haven't because it's a global award, but I have. So let me ask you something. Do you have a philosophy of food? What comes through in your menu?
I definitely draw back to a lot of my time here when I really learned. You know, when I came in here, I thought I knew a lot, and then I was, immediately humbled in classes here. And, you know, in general, when you go out there and work for people, it becomes very humbling. But, I don't even know. Sometimes just inspiration just comes from nowhere. I don't know how to explain it. I'll just be off daydreaming somewhere, and just an idea comes in, and then we just make it happen on a plate.
So describe one of your ideas and where you got inspired and what did it show up at on the plate?
Sure. Okay. we were doing a cheesecake at Shea Catherine one day. I'm just trying to think of a story. And I just, we were doing it in these whole trays and we were cutting it. And I just was not really happy with the presentation. So I'm working on the line one night, like a Saturday night. It's real busy. And I look over at my salad guy, my garmanger cook, Stevie, who's actually now my sous chef. He's been with me for 8 years. So I look over at him. I go, why don't we use ring molds and we'll cook them individually? And he just like looks at me and he's like, I just want your brain for like one day. Like where did that come from? You know, like I don't know. So right now, I'm focusing on, I try and focus on local ingredients and I try and focus on seasonality. And really lately, it's got to be cost because, cost driven is everything right now because the cost of ingredients is crazy.
Tell us about that, because New Jersey is the Garden State.
Right.
And
if you're growing smokestacks. No, I'm just kidding.
Are there a lot of farms that you can source from? What's been happening with the prices?
Sure. There are some local farms. I mean, now we're starting to get into farm market season once May is over. But the way that this spring was, it was so cold and miserable all throughout the month of May. It's going to be a later growing season. There'll be the normal staples, the zucchinis and the eggplants and the beautiful corn eventually coming soon, and the Jersey tomatoes, which we're famous for. So we just had the kickoff for the local farmers market this past Saturday, which is actually an organic farmers market, which is pretty cool.
Is that in Westfield?
It's in Westfield. It's through the Chamber of Commerce puts that on. So the gentleman that runs it is a friend of mine. We're on the board together. So it'll be good to get some of that really nice fresh produce again. The produce is not always the prices. I mean, just the volatility of eggs has been crazy. I've seen the prices from 30 dozen eggs for like down to under $6 and all the way up to like it was up to $22. The fluctuation over the winter was crazy with the chicken flu or whatever was going around. And it just seems like anytime that one thing stabilizes, something else goes out of haywire. So, like, we're constantly, as restaurant operators, we're always looking for something that's inexpensive that we can make taste really good and charge a good price for.
Do you think fine dining has come to a big end? I mean, you'll still have the Percés and the Daniels, but are young chefs looking to do white tablecloth restaurants?
I don't think so. I was at a chef panel with the Restaurant Association, and it had David Burke, a gentleman by the name of, I'm not going to remember his name. He's Eamon. Eamon is his first name. I don't know if he went here or not, but he's at a place uptown, they do all small plates, but he called it fine dining, but there's no tablecloth, and it's a little different. I think the way that people view fine dining, it's not jacket and tie and anymore. It's, you know, people were, they're more casual, but the food can be fancy. So that's what I see. The trend that people want really good, fine food in a casual setting. And that's kind of the way that it's moving, as far as I can see. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
So chef of future success,
right.
Do you have, Can you look out as far as 10 years from now and sort of see yourself or what you want to see for the food world? Or do you have any pet peeves or grand visions?
A lot of the trends now are we're looking at a lot of gluten-free. That's the new hot thing right now. Apparently everybody is gluten-free.
Do you understand that?
No, I don't even – I'm not going to even pretend like I do. One of my pet peeves with that is they say they're gluten free. So right away, as a chef in a kitchen, we think allergy. You know, where's a potential source of cross contamination? Where's this? Where's that? So we say, okay, well, all right. How allergic are you? You know, sometimes we have stuff in the fryer that has flour. We'll mention, oh, then the souffle today is chocolate, but it's not gluten free. Like, oh, that's okay, I can have that. Like. So you're not really gluten-free, you know, and it's just like a buzz term that people, I'm gluten-free. And it's first of all, it's not healthy. If you have celiac is one thing, you shouldn't have it.
Right.
You know, it's bad for you. But these other people that are just, oh, well, it's a diet thing. I'm going to lose weight by doing this. But not really. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, if you exercise and you eat properly, you'll be fine. But, you know, it's the buzzword. It's what's hip and trendy right now. So, that I think sauce on the side kills me too.
Sauce on the side.
That's, you know, it is what it is.
Do you have, let's get into the customer base
sure.
a bit. Who's your favorite customer and who's your least favorite customer?
I have several favorite customers. I have some customers that they are just joys to be around. I know them by name. They know me by name. I would happily hang out with them outside of work. They come in all the time. They're, what do you have today? What are you going to make for me? You know, it just, they don't care. They're just, they want, you know, like whatever's good, you know, they're just happy to be there. And then we have others that are just, you know, I don't know, they walk in the door and they're miserable. They just They I don't know what is so wrong with their lives, but there's just nothing you can do. There's just nothing you can do to please them, and that's just the way it is. So we do our best.
And, so what do you think the formula is for a successful restaurant?
The formula is, spend less than you make.
That's a profitable restaurant.
To me, is success.
That is, okay. Well, that's a good definition of success. There. How different is the restaurant industry today from 5 years ago?
I would say it's vastly different. New Jersey is a different animal because of the liquor license situation.
Tell us about that.
So basically it's almost like a taxi medallion where it's, if you don't have one already, it's really hard to get one from the state. And if you do have one, you can sell it at a premium. So there's one on the market now in Westfield for $850,000.
Really?
Right. And you go to Newark and you can buy one for like $90,000-$100,000, but you can't transfer cities. So there is some legislation in place right now. They're trying to bring it to a vote. Probably not going to happen, especially now with the way that looks like Chris Christie is going to leave his term at some point. Depending on this presidential election, and if not, he's there till next year. So there's a lot of posturing going on in the local New Jersey legislature. So I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of movement on it, but it would offer restaurants like myself to buy a restricted license from the state and be able to serve either a full liquor license or a beer and wine only from certain hours. And, you couldn't have a bar. I mean, there's a lot of stipulations along with it, but that would be amazing for us. Actually, at the moment, what we're looking to do is we are going to take Amuse down. We're going to close Amuse down, and we're starting to look for a new location for Amuse, and we're going to relaunch a new concept in the same space as Amuse, starting probably in August 1st. That's what we're shooting for. We're going to be calling it Butcher Block Burgers, and we're going to be doing a fast casual style burger. We have a very family-oriented town, and we feel like that's a niche that's missing in our town. Again, it's going to be very more upscale than like a fast food place, but we're going to use our beautiful tables, our beautiful plates and all that, but we're going to emphasize more, just a little bit more faster, more casual dining experience. We feel like that's what we need in that area, in that location, and we're going to continue our search for a liquor license and a location for Amuse in the time being.
So when I said 10 years out, maybe like 5 years out, do you see being an Andre Sultner and keeping your restaurant for 40 years?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, my goal with the Butcher Block Burgers is to open many locations and then being able to use that to maybe fund a more high-end project, with that.
What you have to do to have a high-end project?
I feel like that is the kind of what if you look at the way that a lot of these bigger chefs, that's kind of what they're doing. You look at the Danny Myers of the world; those Shake Shacks are doing really good numbers, and they're helping him out with some of the other projects that, if you look at the amount of profit per employee that it takes for Apple some of these other bigger corporations, I mean, it's the numbers are staggering. And then you look at the restaurant, and I think the average profitability per employee is like $6,300, where it's something like $1 billion or something like that for Apple. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
The amount of labor intensive stuff that's going on, and then now we have a lot of different issues coming down. And now I'm speaking as a restaurateur and operator is. There's a minimum wage that they want to raise to $15 an hour. There's paid sick leave they want to put in. They're trying to pass a law for mandatory scheduling where you have to have your schedule set 14 days in advance, and you can't. And if you call someone in that's not supposed to be in, you have to pay them extra for coming in. And if you cut somebody early, you still have to pay them for their time there. So for a restaurant, I mean, that's part of the draw for a lot of restaurant employees is that it's a flexible schedule. I want Friday off. Or I'm going to work. Oh, this one wants to cover my shift. Now they're trying to take that away from us. But it's all these things all at once, and it's really making it hard on mom and pops. They're going after these bigger companies, the McDonald's and the and the, you know, the Walmarts of the world with their some of their practices, but it's really having adverse effect on little guys like us, where, you know, we every dollar matters to us. You know, yeah. We have razor thin margins, about 6-7% profit margin, because we're just using food. It's tight, you know, and then now they're going to cut into that. Eventually,
so
it's going to cut us out.
Pre $15 an hour,
right?
About
6-7%. So
that is tight.
So
that
it's a tight margin.
And then whatever you make, you have to pay taxes on.
Exactly. And it's not the tax of, like, the GE that pays 15%. They
so
come
why,
after
why'd you go in this profession again?
I don't like myself.
How many? But it's a passion, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really good highs and really low lows. You know, it's like a roller coaster every day. But it's rewarding. You get to be a part of people's special occasions in their lives. They come and mark their anniversaries, their birthdays, their baby showers, their bridal showers, their weddings, et cetera, with a meal. And there's something to be said about that. And being part of their lives, and they say, oh, I remember we were at that place. So it's fun. That's a really rewarding part. I try and give back to the community, and we do a lot of fundraisers, you know, handing out gift cards and being involved with all the local stuff as, you know, being part of a community, which is another awesome thing to be a part of.
Well, I think we're running out of time. I know that you have a big event tonight, and you've got to go cross that bridge before the traffic starts.
Absolutely.
Right. So, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've got to get to Westfield. How far is it from Manhattan?
Well, if you jump on the train, you can get right into Westfield, especially if you go. Right now they have single-seat rides between 9 and 2 p.m., so come for lunch. And it's about 40 minutes.
40
on the
minutes.
Train.
Oh,
so
that
it's not
sounds
terrible.
Nice.
And then if you don't take the single seat in between 9 and 2, there's a one changeover in Newark, and it's about 40, 50 minutes. It's not terrible. And you get right into Westfield, you can walk out of the train station, and I'm a half a block away from there.
All right. We're going this summer.
Oh, sounds great.
Thanks, CJ. We're so proud of you.
Thank you.
And I want to give a shout out to Robin Cohen, my producer, and Heritage Radio. We'll see you next time.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.